Welcome to the serialized short story audiobook collection, Bones Are White, by Scott Sigler. Get the stories in Bones Are White for all ebook readers at scottsigler.com/bonesarewhite, or from that same page as a full-length audiobook. You can also buy the ebook version directly from the Kindle Store, the Nook Store, Apple's iBooks, and from Google Play. This book contains harsh language, adult situations, and lots of violence. So if you're easily offended, cue up some Taylor Swift and enjoy. From Hunter Hunterson's Hunter Diary, September 26th, 2011.
Welcome back to my war journal. The fact that you've read this far might mean you aren't easily offended. That, or you're just stubborn, or you're looking for something to protest. But if you're easily offended, I suggest shutting this book right now because this installment might be slightly politically incorrect. To say moving to San Francisco has been a little bit of a culture shock for my family is an understatement. I mean, it's akin to saying that the first time a doc checks you for prostate cancer, the feeling is a wee bit surprising. Or maybe that the first time a rabid unicorn stabs his horn at your privates is slightly disconcerting. First off, we got all the kids in school. Except, of course, for Billy Mack, my fucking retard of a son, who just sits in the basement playing that infernal Xbox and eating more food than a Prager's grizzly bear with a tapeworm. I mean, these schools, liberal this and liberal that, accept any lifestyle or any belief unless it's Christian or conservative, which you're allowed to hate and insult all you like, mind you, then keep your mouth shut lest you want to get labeled some kind of antichrist, which is kind of ironic when you think about it. We went from believing the same thing that most of our neighbors believe to being told that everything we cherished wasn't just wrong, it was evil, and we were just plain stupid for cherishing it in the first place. We'd been brainwashed, you see, because smart people just understood Christianity was for those incapable of thinking for themselves. I tell you, if it weren't for Betty Lou in my ear, and sometimes in my head with that telepathy thing of hers, telling me to be patient and forgiving, I'd have put some sanctimonious, arrogant, judgmental smiles in direct contact with their owner sphincters. So new schools were a major change in our lives, as was the cost of living. Now, I know Betty Lou says we make more than we used to, and we come out on top by a right fair margin, but still, $15 for a fucking hamburger? And try finding a decent barbecue joint in this city. Good luck. Have to head over to Oakland to even get in a ballpark of good. And then there's the fact that for the first time in probably 20 years, I ain't my own boss anymore. Sometimes the sacrifices you make for your family take a little piece of your manhood. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't make the same choice 100 times in a row, mind you, because taking care of your wife and kids is a true man's role in the world, no matter what them fucking liberals will tell you. But it ain't easy going from calling all your own shots to weekly progress meetings with a man whose name you can't even pronounce. Every time he says it, it sounds like Inkve. My boss's last name ties up my tongue in knots worse than the first time I tried to talk to Betty Lou back in the 6th grade in Slayerville. I've taken to calling the man Trigger to make it more palatable, but he doesn't seem to like that all that much. Now, don't get me wrong. I like Inkve Solsjet just fine. He dresses funny and has that accent that makes him sound dumber than a bad guy guard in a Schwarzenegger movie, but he's a fair man, and he ain't done me wrong or lied to me in any way. But I tell you, that man's management style? I mean, who tracks the supernatch with bar graphs, project plans, and some satanic device known as a Gantt chart? Gantt. Sounds like something that would slither out of an Oni's rectum about 4 hours after an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet. Yet maybe the most surprising thing has been moving from our farmhouse to a mansion as big as something Richard Petty would own. I'm not saying the old farmhouse was run down, mind you, but maintaining the place wasn't exactly our primary focus, if you hear what I'm saying. Me and my family spent our time chasing the supernatch and pulling tickets to put food on the table. So maybe a fresh coat of paint or a new bead of caulk weren't high up on the list of priorities. Betty Lou did what she could to keep the place spruced up and homey, but with her working 3 shifts a week down at the secondhand store, she couldn't do much in the way of maintenance and repair. We had us a collapsing front porch, a sagging garage, a kitchen floor that dipped down in the middle, a back door screen on one hinge that I'd never quite got round to fixing, and kitchen cabinets that hadn't exactly fit right the day I put them in 20 years earlier. On a side note, ever put something prefab together and when you're done, you got those three or four parts that didn't make the final cut, so to speak, and you don't know what those parts were for? Yeah, our kitchen cabinets were like that. And hell, the house was in that condition before the imp infestation. Now, if you've ever had them little bastards wiggling through your walls, well, I don't need to tell you how much fun that is. You find an exterminator who knows how to get rid of imps good and proper, and I'll show you a man who buys a new dually with cash on the barrel head. Which is to say, we hired three exterminators, and not one of them could de-impify our domicile. Nasty creatures, those imps. Always spitting and shitting all over the place, trying to learn how to use the TiVo so they could record days of our lives. Fucking worthless, I'll tell you. But I digress. What I'm trying to say is that moving from a three-bedroom farmhouse to a mansion with, well, shit. Come to think of it, I don't actually know how many rooms this place has. Something like 20 or 30, I think. Hell, it's got two dining rooms. Two dining rooms. It ain't like we're housing 150 Cuban refugees, just a family of six. Well, granted, my boy Bo probably counts as a person and a half, but not two people outright. Near as I can figure, we've got four or five rooms for every person in the damn house. I mean, sure, it's a good thing that Bo and Luke don't have to share a room anymore, but this seems a little bit like fishing for perch with dynamite. And we don't even know what's in some of them rooms. They're shut up tight, both with physical locks and all kinds of wards and spells and whatnot. Yngwie told us it's best if we don't mess with those magics. I got the impression I wasn't meant to ask for more information. And I won't ask, for now. But sooner or later, I'm going to have a talk with old Trigger and get me some answers about this house. Mostly on account of what happened yesterday. Sakes alive, if the boys back in Slayerville could see me now, they'd laugh harder than they would at a Larry the Cable Guy show. Goddamn humiliating, I tell you. But enough of my bitching. Let me tell you how I came to deal with some fucking San Francisco fairies. A light fog floated through San Francisco's Pacific Heights neighborhood. The lights of multi-million dollar mansions glowed like soft pearls, their edges slightly blurred by the wisps of moisture. High-rise, high-rent apartment buildings sat side by side with pristine houses and sublime mansions. These buildings would have been worth millions anywhere in the world, but in the inflated real estate market of the city by the bay, their value soared by factors of 10, by 15, maybe even 20. In one of the world's most expensive places, the concept of location, location, location still applies. This neighborhood, these mansions, they are even beyond the fabled 1% that have so many people marching downtown, protesting the perceived inequities of the haves and have-nots. These houses? They're owned by people who were more aptly described as the 1%'s 1%. On Broadway Street, only the occasional car rolls along the blacktop. Homeowners here don't like to get out much. Perfectly manicured little lawns never feel the weight of feet. What little traffic there is mostly consists of gawkers, tourists, and people driving by to take in a level of splendor that they will never know. On the south side of the street, on the sidewalk, a man rode a bicycle. It was an old bicycle, dented and dinged with use, painted over a dozen times. Most recently, a pale green. Fingernail-polished drawings of flowers dotted the frame and the bike's rims. Dried flowers were woven into the spokes. Upon that bike rode an old man with long, thin, gray hair. He wore ripped jeans. Not ripped because it was fashionable to do so, but ripped because they'd been owned so long and worn so often that the denim was thin as paper. Patches upon patches held the pants together, while a rope belt kept them from falling off his narrow hips. The man wore leather sandals and a brown, knit satchel strung over the shoulder of his multicolored Grateful Dead t-shirt. The shirt's material was even thinner than the jeans, so thin that, in some places, you could almost see through it to the old white skin beneath. Sandaled feet stopped pedaling, pushed backward to slow the bike to a stop across the street from a white stone mansion at 2222 Broadway. The old man looked at the building. He looked at the smooth white walls. He looked at the towering arched front door, at the spiral columns on either side, columns that supported a small, ornate porch backed by three windows. 3 stories tall, squat and square, topped by a shallow-angled black roof. This building had been here for a long time, far longer than most San Franciscans even knew, really. Far longer than there had even been a state of California, or a country of the United States of America. The house hadn't always looked like this, of course, and it hadn't always been here, but it had existed in many shapes and had been in many places. It had also been used for many purposes. The current iteration of this house suited the old man's needs. There was a new sheriff in town. The old man reached into his satchel and pulled out a joint as long and as thick as his middle finger. Most people would have called it a cigar, not a joint, but it was just a hair over medium size by his standards. He put it in his mouth, then dug again for a lighter. The lighter had dancing bears on it. He lit the joint. When he inhaled, the end glowed, but not with the orange one might expect. His joint glowed green. The old man held the smoke deep in his lungs. He coughed once, just a little, but held it in. Then he exhaled a cloud of sparkling green smoke. The smoke thinned and dissipated as it billowed lightly outward. By the time it reached the house, it looked no different than the gently rolling fog. The old man smiled. "Wake up, my little Susie," he said. Then he put his feet to the pedals and rolled off down the sidewalk, humming a tune as he did.
"Pa," Luke said, "please pass a chicken."
Dinner with my whole family plus a guest. Few things in life bring me this much joy. Kentucky whooping up on Duke in the NCAAs is close, as is watching that victory lap in the Brickyard 500. Or maybe that one time I got to pull the ticket on a honky-tonk ghost who was haunting the Grand Ole Opry. But those are all tied for second at best. Our first night in the mansion that was our new home. Everyone was there. My sons, Bo and Luke, my daughter, Sunshine, my lovely wife, Betty Lou, and the guest at our table, Yngwie Solset, the man in charge of the Netherworld Protectorate for all of the San Francisco Bay Area. Betty Lou had gone shopping, and she'd done it upright. Fried chicken, cornbread, mashed taters, and some kind of beans I didn't recognize, although I sure as hell ate them, I can tell you that. Considering our new paycheck from the NP, I wasn't supposed to be upset about what things in San Francisco cost. But then I saw the receipt from some place called Whole Foods. Chicken is $9 a fucking pound. How a place like Whole Foods can stay in business, I have no idea. It's best if I don't go down there, lest I have a discussion with management about price gouging and selling food to working families at a fair, affordable rate. $9 a pound. I never. Luke had already knocked down 2 legs and a breast by my count, but I hoped he'd at least double that. Damn boy is so skinny, he needs all the weight he can pack on. I passed him the platter. "Here you go, son." He took another breast.
"Thanks, Pa."
I set the platter down, but it barely clinked to a stop before Bo reached across the table and grabbed a leg, a wing, and a thigh in one sausage-fingered hand. If I could have spoke fast enough, I'd have warned him, but like the speed of light, some things just move quicker than you can process. A flash, a crack of eldritch energy, the smell of ozone, and Bo's hand shot back across the table, those same sausage fingers shaking with pain.
"Ouch, Ma, they're hurt!"
Bo's booming words echoed off the walls of this ridiculously huge dining room. The dining room alone has more square footage than our whole house back in Slayerville. This table seats 12 comfortably, and in this room, it looks like a life raft floating in the middle of an ocean. My wife waggled a ring-encrusted finger at Bo.
"If you don't want the discipline, then you mind your manners.
We raised you better than to reach across a table like somebody who ain't never had a proper dinner in their whole life. You want our guests to think we're just common white trash?
There was almost too much irony in that comment to process without laughing, but I'd learned years ago that there's times it's best to shut the hell up and times a snicker can get you in more trouble than you could ever want. Betty Lou takes dinner guests real serious. If I started cackling that she'd called my black son white trash, well, the next stinger spell would land on me. Bo put his fingers in his mouth. Maybe it was because they hurt, or maybe it was because they had some chicken grease on them. My son gets powerful hungry and sometimes forgets his manners.
Sorry, Ma, Bo said.
He turned to Yngwie.
Mr. Solshet, could you please pass the chicken?
Yngwie nodded gracefully and passed the platter.
Of course, my young man. Betty Lou, I must say that this is a positively delicious meal.
For a woman who gears up for dinner with the intensity of one of them MMA fighters waiting to hear the words, "Let's get it on!" Betty Lou sure seems to get flustered when guests compliment her.
Oh,
she said, a smile breaking across that pretty face and pulling her red flushing cheeks up high.
Well, thank you, Mr. Solset.
She pronounces it Solset. How the hell does anyone get Solset out of that conflagration of consonants? I mean, it's S-J-O-E-L-S-E-T. For God's sakes, there's a J in there. Yngwie bowed to her. Bowed to her, for fuck's sake, like this was a goddamn Three Musketeers movie or something.
The thanks is all to you, he said. Your first night in the Stone Mansion and you invite me to dinner, I am quite honored.
She turned so red she might have been a radish. She looked down at the table, all flustered, and I figured I wouldn't hear a peep out of her for another 5 minutes or so. My wife loves me more than anything in this world or the next, but damn if she don't get all a Twitter when high society types butter her up. It would have annoyed me a mite if Yngwie hadn't seemed genuine with the words, so I guess it was all right. Yngwie wore a button-down shirt with an Argyle sweater vest on top of it. He tucked his napkin into his collar in a way that would have got his ass kicked back in Kentucky. Hell, that sweater vest alone made me want to rub a little bit of mashed taters in his face, just for general purposes, and I like the guy. He looked like he combed his black hair about 50 times a day. As the NP director of the Bay Area, I imagine old Yngwie can conjure up a double-sized can of magical whoop-ass, but if it ever got down to bare knuckles, I'd bet my left nut that my 100-pound daughter could knock him out midway through the second round. Sunshine kept giving the man goo-goo eyes. She's 15. She'd give the goo-goo eyes to a Thanksgiving turkey if it talked with a cultured accent.
Mr. Yngwie, she said, you must be real powerful in the magic to be head of the NP in a big city like this.
Yngwie dabbed that napkin at the corner of his mouth and tilted his head a little bit to the side, his way of shrugging out an aw shucks, I guess.
I have reasonable power reserves, my dear.
She put her elbows on the table, linked her fingers, and rested her chin on top.
Mr. Yngwie, what kind of magic do you got?
Betty Lou shot her a glare that made me sit up straight.
Sunshine, that is a rude question, and you know it, Betty Lou said. Elbows.
Sunshine sat back quickly. Yngwie laughed.
Please, Mrs. Hunterson, I don't mind. Sunshine, I am an ingester.
Sunshine's eyes lit up, and she almost put her elbows back on the table before she remembered herself.
You practice food magic?
He did that little tilt again.
No, I'm not a cook. I don't draw power from preparation. My powers are a little bit more pedestrian than that.
By the way, listener, if you ever figure out what the hell more pedestrian means, throw me an email, will you? Hunter@HunterHuntersonAndSons.com. I mean, I hear hoity-toity people say that phrase all the time, and I just don't get it. What does walking on foot have to do with anything? So you ain't driving a car, so what? I mean, Lewis and Clark, they discovered half the goddamn country without a car. Anyways, I digress.
I draw power from what I eat, Yngwie said. It's always a bit of a gamble if I stray from my primary pre-planned entrees that are prepared by my personal chef. Tonight's repast, for example, could produce any number of wondrous spells and enchantments. Why, the cornbread alone is so heavenly, I could probably conjure up an army of angels to carry me into the stratosphere.
Betty Lou turned all red and looked down again. Damn, but that man's got away with words.
Yngwie looked at me and smiled. You know the kind of smile I'm talking about. Genuine and well-meaning, but all in the mouth and none in the eyes. Whatever made that man truly happy, it wasn't having dinner with a bunch of redneck monster stompers.
Hunter, he said, what do you think of your new abode?
I swallowed down my bit of cornbread. Betty Lou had been acting a little strange all day, and she wouldn't take kindly to poor manners. Talking with her mouthful at our meals can get you a bit of supercharged dime store jewelry correction just as fast as reaching across the table.
Well, Trigger, what I've seen of it so far looks right nice, I said. Of course, I've only been walking around the place for 8 hours, so I imagine at least 3/4 of it has yet to be explored. I made as far as the bedroom, the bathroom, the kitchen, and the living room. Then I had to rest my legs as I ain't used to a hike of that magnitude.
He laughed, this time, a little bit with the eyes as well.
Stone Mansion is quite large, Hunter.
Of course, there were a few rooms I couldn't get into, on account of they were locked. Where might we find the keys?
His smile faded.
I think you and your family have plenty of space without those rooms, don't you?
My smile faded as well.
Now, looky here, Trigger. I don't take kindly to the idea of locked rooms in my own house.
He just shook his head in a way that said, your concern is both noted and irrelevant. Landlords. Don't matter what the economic level, they tend to be pricks. Betty Lou finally looked up. She was still all flustered with the compliment, but she'd also noticed the locked doors and wasn't crazy about potential threats living under the same roof with her daughter and her 3 baby boys.
Mr. Solset, she said, I have been getting some bad feelings here.
Please, call me Yngwie, said the smooth talker. You're an empath, Betty Lou, and this house is built over a fault, so perhaps bad feelings are to be expected?
The place was built over a goddamn paranormal fault? Well, that would have been nice info to have before we unloaded the U-Haul, wouldn't it? Betty Lou shook her head.
No, sir, I've been by fault lines before. You're right that those bring a mean feeling, but this is different. Like it's coming from specific individuals instead of leaking out of hell.
Yngwie's smile didn't fade this time, but what was left looked more forced than it had been before.
That's interesting, he said.
Betty Lou looked down but kept talking.
Then I couldn't help but notice that you've got some level 7 wards on some of the doors in this place. I mean, level 7 is so powerful I can't even see what's on the other side. I've only seen wards like that on my own prison cells.
Yngwie sighed.
Betty Lou, Hunter, with all due respect, there's ample room for you and your family in this fine home. There are, indeed, a few convicts sealed up in those rooms. They can't get out due to the power of the house. The doors were sealed by some of the best magi in the Northern Hemisphere.
Magi? I said. Which magi?
Yngwie looked at me.
Top magi, Mr. Hunterson.
He wasn't about to give me names. That made me uncomfortable.
Yngwie, what my lovely wife is saying is that it's a mite scary to live in a house with locked doors and not know what's behind them.
He pulled the napkin out of his collar and stood.
I understand what you're saying, Mr. Hunterson, but those rooms are safely sealed. There is nothing to worry about.
I stood up as well. I tried to make it respectful, not intimidating, but sometimes I just can't help myself.
I apologize, Yngwie, but sometimes I don't speak all that clearly and my meaning gets muddled up in the words. What I am trying to communicate is that we want those rooms unsealed and we want whatever convicts in them gone. It would make the place more livable if you follow my meaning.
He stared at me.
Unfortunately, that is not an option.
On some deals, you get the price you want. On some deals, you pay the price they're asking. And on some deals, you just have to know when to walk away.
Well then, Trigger, I guess we'll be finding some other place to live.
He didn't look the least bit happy.
I'm sorry to hear that you won't be taking the Marshal's position after all.
What the hell was he talking about?
Are you telling me that if I want to be the Marshal of San Francisco, I have to live in this house?
Yngwie nodded.
I'm afraid it's a package deal, Mr. Hunterson. The Marshal and his or her family live here. We must have a presence atop the fault line. You are my first choice for the position, of course,
But if you choose to decline it, I'm sure your old friend Meg Marshall would be happy to move right in.
Remember when I said I liked the guy? Well, I was wrong.
You can't be serious, I said. If you get Marshall, you'll have a raving, leather-pants-wearing, true-death-em-all psycho riding herd on San Francisco. You need me for this rodeo, so you listen real close. My family is...
Hunter, shut up!
To all the menfolk reading this, I imagine that either now or at some point in your life, you've had a significant other. Now don't start calling me a goddamn homophobe or heterocentric or whatever your goddamn liberal holier-than-thou word of the day is, because I didn't say wife or girlfriend. I said significant other. If you and your boy are more than just boys, so to speak, I could give a steamy duck shit about it. Every man who's had someone permanent-like in their life has had said significant other get all hellfire excited about something, and that significant other's voice might rise in volume a few hundred decibels and rise in pitch by an octave or two until some of what that other said could only be understood by wincing dogs or maybe by evil creatures who speak in a language that sounds suspiciously like rusty nails on a new chalkboard. Now, for the sake of understanding the unique slice of joy that is my life, imagine that voice pressed right up against your eardrum from the inside and blaring with the intensity of an F-15 flyby. And you can imagine that level of shrill, then you know what it feels like inside my head when Betty Lou cranks up the naggin' wagon and projects her thoughts into my skull.
God damn it, woman, you trying to kill me with that mind blast of yours? You don't say a word, Hunter. We need this job, and we will do whatever it takes to keep it. So you say thank you to Yngwie, and you do it now.
I might have flinched that last syllable, the way you did that one and only time you zipped your nuts up in your jeans. It was just that loud.
All right, Trigger, I said. We'll stay, but I think dinner is over.
I could work this out with my wife later, behind closed doors, and when the family and my new boss weren't around. She better have a good reason for all this hullabaloo, but Betty Lou don't do much without good reason. Yngwie folded his napkin just so. He'd been dabbing that thing in his mouth every 5 seconds, yet I noticed there wasn't any food on the napkin. It looked as clean as when he'd unfolded it. I think maybe that rich people somehow have an anti-drip force field that takes crumbs and teleports them to another dimension. He set his napkin next to his plate.
Thank you for dinner, Betty Lou.
I nodded at Beau.
Son, say Mr. Solstice out.
Really got to work on the pronunciation of his name. Of course, I was looking at that stupid sweater vest, and I really wanted to beat him up for wearing it. I'm not as bad as I used to be in that category, but I have dreams that someday I'll mature enough to not want to kick the shit out of some Nancy boys just on account of the fact that he's wearing something that ain't quite normal enough for my taste. Bo stood and walked Trigger out of the dining room. The front door is somewhere around here. I'm just not sure how many lefts and rights it takes to reach it. Maybe I need to hire one of them Sherpas or something. Betty Lou stood and started gathering plates. I reached out to help her, but she shook her head.
Hunter, why don't you take a plate down to Billy Mac? Take a plate to Billy Mac? For the blood of Christ, woman, the only exercise that boy gets is walking to the kitchen and back. We start playing gravy train and taking the food to him, we might as well block up his coronaries with I can't believe it's not butter and see if we can negotiate ahead for an off-season deal on a mortician.
That wasn't exactly true. Billy Mac does exercise one part of his body. The boy's video game thumbs could probably punch a hole through battleship steel. Betty Lou gave me that look that said no matter how much fact, reason, and logic were on my side, things were going to go her way, no matter how ridiculous her way might be.
Hunter, please, she said, go make sure your son has something to eat.
I leaned back. So did Luke and Sunshine. Sometimes Betty Lou yells with a voice inside your head. Sometimes she speaks real quiet and yells with her eyes. The latter is far, far worse.
I'll get right on it, my sweet cornbread muffin, I said. And I'll take him some cake, too.
Her eyes narrowed a little more, but then she nodded.
Kids, help me clean up.
Luke and Sunshine couldn't have stood up any quicker if they had afterburners stuck up their asses. My children started clearing the table so fast I panicked a little in fear that I wouldn't be able to make a full plate for Billy Mac. Next thing you know, I actually scooped out mashed potatoes with my hand and flung them on a plate. It was a good thing, too, because Sunshine ripped the serving bowl out of my hand a split second later. I threw some cornbread and a couple of pieces of chicken on the plate and turned to leave. Betty Lou was mad enough to kill someone. Since I'm the head of the household and main economic provider and all, it would be better if one of the kids took the heat instead of me. As Bill Cosby once stated, I can make another one that looks just like him. Hunter, Betty Lou said. I turned, thinking her face might split into a conniption fit because I touched my retarded son's taters with my bare hand, but she was holding something out for me. A box of chocodiles. Give him this, she said. Someday when I die, I'll have to ask the Almighty where I went wrong as a father. I got three kids who are smart, mostly, well-behaved, a lot of the times anyway, and do what they can to help out the family. Then I got one kid who don't do shit but funnel my money to that asshole Bill Gates, and does God put challenges in the kid's way to make him better? No. Instead, he has the boy's paranormal saint of a mother shower him with chocolate-dipped Twinkies. Sometimes. Kind of agree with them atheists. I took the box. I will, my deep-fried dumpling. And may I say that dinner was better than a 3-pound bass jumping clean into the boat? Hey, listener, maybe I don't have Ingve's vocabulary, but I do the best I can. Betty Lou pursed her lips and turned to clear the table, but Luke and Sunshine had all but made the dishes teleport away. Come to think of it, Sunshine might have actually teleported them. She's been working on her spells, the little whippersnapper. Betty Lou started wringing her hands. She kind of forgot I was there, I think. Then she walked to the kitchen. At least, I think she walked toward the kitchen, as still not really sure where that is either. Aside from the shitter in my bedroom, I only knew where one other room was for sure. The basement. I sighed and headed for it. Plate of food in one hand, box of chocodiles in the other. On the third floor next to the library, a brass door lock started to glow green with eldritch energy. Runes engraved into the metal blazed the brightest, as if they absorbed this energy, tried to store it in a place where it would be of no use. But like a sponge soaking up dripping water, eventually the runes became saturated. The energy started to overflow. Energy dripped down to the marble floor, green and molten, and splattering and hissing against the black-veined white. The brass door handle glowed brighter. The metal started to sag and slough away.
You have been listening to The Bones Are White, serialized short story audiobook, written by Scott Sigler. This audiobook was produced by A. Kovacs and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. For information on the author or to hear his free weekly fiction podcast, go to scottsigler.com. Theme music is the song Greed by the band Separation of Sanity.
I am a creeping cancer, rots you to the core, pumping through your blackened heart, seduction of your soul, separation of your senses, sanity, your currency. I am your rolling gun, on your knees, kiss and scream.
Every 5 minutes, a transplant candidate dies while waiting for a compatible heart, liver, or kidney. Imagine a technology that could provide those life-saving transplant organs for a high price, and imagine what a company would do to monopolize that technology. On a remote island in Lake Superior, a team of geneticists unlocks this holy grail of medicine by reverse engineering the genomes of all mammals, creating an animal with organs perfectly suitable for human transplantation. They envisioned a docile herd animal, but one team member had another, darker vision. This ancestor is anything but docile. The team's work spawns something big, something evil, something very, very hungry. Ancestor is a complete serialized fiction podcast by number one New York Times bestselling novelist Scott Sigler, with all episodes available. Binge the entire story now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.